Welcome back to Techonomics. I am your host, Jason Middleton. Now we're going to not talk about The Art of the Deal, which is apparently some kind of popular book title. We are going to talk about the science behind negotiating. Now think about how much negotiating you do at work, at home, even with a horse. That'll make more sense in a few minutes. Coming now, we have a Stanford professor, and she recently wrote the book, Getting More of What You Want, How the Secrets of Economics and Psychology Can Help You Negotiate Anything in Business and in Life.
Margaret A. Neal, I'm the Adams Distinguished Professor of Management at the Graduate School of Business at Stanford University.
And you also have a new book out called Getting More of What You Want. You're a master of negotiations. And I think that a lot of listeners, they really only realize they're negotiating two major things in their life. It's usually a home sale or a job interview or salary. And you touch on both of those in the book. And I wonder if we could start with that. First, my producer wanted me to ask if you could tell us how to get the courage to ask for that negotiation, especially at work.
Well, I think one of the major hurdles that people have when they're thinking about negotiation is they view negotiation as a battle. And that battle is characterized by, I'm going to try to get stuff from you that you don't want to give me. And I'm going to try to keep you from getting stuff that I don't want you to have. Mm-hmm. As soon as I view negotiation as a battle, then I armor up. And even if my counterpart doesn't have that view of negotiation, as soon as they see me all armored up and ready for battle, they get armored up and we have a fight. So what happens for many of us is we severely limit the numbers of negotiations that we are willing to do, because we don't want to pick a fight with the other side.
Right, adversarial kind
right.
of thing.
Right. So rather than thinking of negotiation solely as a battle, what you might want to reconsider and where we focus on the book is that you think about it not as a battle, but as collaborative problem solving. Now, before you say, oh, yeah, I know that. That's like the win-win. Let's everybody get together and feel
right.
good.
Right.
I'm not really suggesting that. What I'm suggesting is that in collaborative problem solving, what you're looking for is a solution that makes you, the focal negotiator, better off than your status quo,
mm-hmm.
better off than had you not negotiated. Well,
I see.
That may be a low bar. You'd say, well, why would you negotiate to be worse off? And yet all of us have taken a deal where we believe we thought we were going to get a good deal, but in the end we get a deal that makes us worse off. We should not have negotiated. So what I think is useful is for us to think about a solution that makes us better off first,
mm-hmm.
but then, and this is really important, negotiation, there's no command and control in it. It's about influence. So I have got to present a proposal to you, my counterpart,
mm-hmm.
that from your perspective at least keeps you whole or makes you better off.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, why would you say yes?
So you're searching for value propositions to bring to the table as well. Should we say to the table? That automatically sets up an adversarial bent, doesn't it?
Well, it kind of does. It's like, especially when we're across the table from each other as
right.
opposed to on the same side of the table.
Hmm.
Because actually that's a good analogy, Jason, because what I want people to think about is it's you and me against this problem that we have. And the problem may be, you know, I want to get a promotion. I want to get a raise. I want to get a good compensation contract.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's we're back to the compensation talk because that is a common negotiation. I think a lot of people think of that automatically. And one of the points in the book that really stood out to me was, frankly, math on the radio. It's the $7,000 question. Could you help extrapolate that example, please?
Sure, and I'll do it in round numbers. So one of the things that's interesting is because people see negotiation as a battle and they really don't want to get in a fight unless it's really, really important – it's not surprising that sometimes people, when they get an opportunity for a position and they're asked, you know, basically to accept an offer, they don't negotiate because they think the amount of money that they might be able to negotiate is really not worth the risk to their reputation of being greedy or demanding or not nice.
Mm.
And I think that is actually not the right answer.
Okay.
Because if you actually consider how valuable that early negotiation is, so think about this. Let's say that for ease of math, I get made a job offer for $100,000 a year, and so do you. We're in the same company,
mm-hmm.
okay? Now, you negotiate, and let's say you get about a $7,000 increase, okay? So you start off at $107,000. I start off at $100,000.
Okay.
Now, we're going to make two heroic assumptions. The first assumption is that the company to which we both work now treats us identically. They give us the same raise every year. Let's say it's 5%.
Okay.
Now, the second heroic assumption is that you and I stay at this organization for the next 35 years, because we're very young, we're only 30.
Right.
Right. So we then, you decide, who has negotiated, decide to retire at 65. And the question that I ask my students is, and my students are both graduate students and executives, how much longer will I have to work in order to be as wealthy as you are when you retire?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer turns out to be a surprising 8 years.
Wow.
But that's a very conservative estimate, because think about how the company sees us. So over the course of those 35 years, you, who started off at $107,000, I started off at $100,000, not really a big difference. But over the course of those 35 years, that difference is in excess annually of $100,000 a year. You're making $100,000 more a year than I am.
Whoa.
So how does the company interpret that difference? Do they say, oh, right, remember 35 years ago Jason negotiated and Maggie didn't?
Right.
Nobody's even alive who remembers that. What they say is, Jason must be better. Otherwise, why would we be paying him so much more? So rather than giving both Jason and Maggie the same 5% raise, let's give Jason 6%.
Okay.
And Maggie, 5% over those 35 years.
Okay, right.
Now, how many more years will I have to work?
I'm trying to do math on the radio again. I'm not
good
at it.
Okay, let me just give you won't guess it.
I'm sure.
Over 40 years.
That's astonishing. That's astonishing. All because of assumed excellence, because of an upfront negotiation that happened when I was 30 years old.
Yes.
That's amazing. And your book goes further into that, too. It's called Getting More of What You Want by Dr. Margaret Neal. Let's go back to your student block for a second, because mm-hmm. recent research has shown that before you're 32, you're going to have four jobs in this new economy. Mm-hmm. Now, are there different approaches for negotiations for people in different age groups? And because you have a wide spectrum of already high-powered people mm-hmm. in your classes to people who are learning.
So the answer is that the real critical characteristic is how many people want you,
mm-hmm.
right? And that gives you power in the negotiation. But more importantly, and I think that so that's the first thing. I mean, if you've got 10 job offers, then it's a lot easier for you to negotiate than this is the only job
right,
offer you have.
Sure.
Right. And the more senior you are, probably the more in demand you are, as a general rule.
Right, right.
But even when you're first starting out, one of the biggest errors that people make is they focus on a single issue. They say, I want more money. And this, focusing on that single issue, is a problem. Because if you're concerned about how your reputation is, will people think you're greedy or demanding or not nice,
mm-hmm.
that sets you up for a battle. That sets you up for a fight.
And we're back to that
right.
adversarial thing.
So a much better strategy is rather than say, I want more salary, is to think broadly of the resources that you need in order to be able to do the job well. And when you have a package of issues rather than a single issue, and salary certainly could be one of those issues, what happens then is it's a lot easier to think of that as solving a problem. Here's a proposal that I'm making, and not only do I want more salary, but I want more technical support. I want more marketing support. I want the opportunity to work from home. Whatever fits into your particular career mm-hmm. goals, you're going to better position yourself for the next promotion, for the next raise. And even if you don't get that increased salary, you might get other things that could, in fact, put you in a better position to be excellent in your performance in the job, which will make it easier for the next salary raise.
I see. So a holistic approach to the entire thing. Keeping both of us whole is something that is important. Two of us on one side of the table facing down a problem together.
Yes.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the word strategy in that answer, and I wonder how much planning goes into pre-negotiation, because I imagine you would like it to be a knee-jerk after they take your class to be able to just deal with it.
Absolutely not, Jason. One of the most important things people can do is plan and prepare, and it's one of the things we have under our control, right? Mm-hmm. In the negotiation, sometimes the other side acts in ways we don't predict. But the more planning and preparation we have, the less likely that is to occur. We're actually going to be able to predict their behavior better. Mm-hmm. But think about how I've talked about that problem-solving perspective. I've got to understand you, my counterpart, to be able to figure out how to craft a proposal that, from your perspective, solves a problem that you have.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. This sounds like a lot of work.
Well, think about my example of you and me negotiating and how much value can be created by that.
So do the work up front, save yourself 40 years of in the labor force.
Exactly.
Got it. Right on. Let's talk about status quo for a second. It's hard for some people to abut status quo or try to move it around. Is that a consideration that comes up early, or is that something that, like, are you in the middle of a negotiation maybe and then you get, let's say, cold feet, if you will, to push against this wall? I had a friend who told me you don't know how far you've moved the wall beating your head against it until you step back and look. So I'm wondering if that kind of approach, status quo, is that like a game changer, or is that a psychological thing that you can overcome?
Well, when you talk about the status quo, what happens is that's a certain outcome. We know what it is. We've lived it, so we become comfortable with it. And, you know, as I try to negotiate a promotion, I try to negotiate a new job, all of that is uncertain. And so what I've got to be able to do is I've got to be able to basically, with my preparation and my planning, reduce that level of uncertainty to one that I can manage. And so part of it is I need to understand very clearly what is important to me. What am I trying to achieve, right? What would be a good deal and what is a bad deal? And this is really important because most folks walk into a negotiation and all they want to do is get a yes. And that's
a hard stance.
Well, that turns out that is an easy thing. If you're negotiating with me, I think it's great if what you want is a yes, because I can give you a yes, but the surplus, the value in the negotiation is going to come to me because what you care most about is that yes.
I see.
And you don't know when you're better off with a no.
That's a great point. Let's unpack that one a little bit, because I've been told no a few times and it actually has worked out. I mean, but I walked away. I got a no and I was like, okay, thanks, bye. And one time I did it with a net and one time I did it without a net. Now, of course, safer with a net. Without a net did not go over well at home, but I figured it out eventually. So what is the bottom line when it comes to negotiating, and what do you have to have in your heart of hearts when you go into it?
Well, first you need to be clear about what it is. So think about this. You talk about having a net or not having a net. And that's a really important thing to understand. So what happens to you if you say no? What are your alternatives, basically? And those alternatives are really important, because the better your alternatives, the easier it is for you to walk away, right? Because you've got a great alternative. And so what happens is that you first need to understand where your alternatives are. Then once you understand that, because your alternatives are outside the negotiation, right? You and I are negotiating. Our alternatives are what happens if we don't get a deal, right? So then I have to say, okay, well, in this negotiation with Jason, what's the worst possible deal that I'd be willing to accept, right? And I need to know that in advance, because we human beings really do want to get to yes. And what happens is if we don't have a clear boundary, then pretty much what we just say is, let's just keep negotiating and I'll keep giving and I hope you keep giving, but eventually let's get to yes. And then we get to a yes and it's yes, we've succeeded, but there's no basis other than the yes. It's not that we got a good deal. It's not that I'm better off than my alternatives.
I see.
I just got a yes.
Right.
So I need to know where that point is. And that is a bright line standard. That is something you don't violate.
I see. That's your red line. Okay.
And that's really easy to say, by the way, and it's really hard to do.
I would imagine so, because you really have to have stones in order to get to that point. So you have to have a value system that you trust, and you have to put proper value on everything around you in your holistic approach. Is that too simplistic?
Well, that's not too simplistic, but that's hard to do. So you've outlined it, but it takes a lot of work to do that.
I see.
And the commitment to being able to walk away, right? That is so huge. And by the way, what's interesting is you don't have to be aggressive when you walk away, right? You could just say, you know, I would really like to have this position. I think this company is great, but I simply can't accept the terms of this contract. In doing so, you might actually encourage your counterpart to be more concessionary towards you.
Right.
Because if you're offered a bad deal and you say yes, you know exactly what you're going to get. That bad deal. But if you say no in as polite a way as possible, you may motivate them to give you more.
You might trigger their human need that you mentioned earlier about trying to get to yes.
Yes.
Interesting.
Exactly.
That's a good takeaway right there. You had another point in your book I'd like to unpack a little bit. It's a phrase, actually, that I kind of stumbled on myself, and it was issue by issue. Can you help me understand what you meant by issue by issue?
Well, we've actually alluded to it a little bit when we talked about don't just ask for salary increase, right? Have a package. Because one of the most common ways people think it is correct to negotiate is if you have multiple issues, go issue by issue. It seems simple, right? We figure one out, we move on. We figure the second one out. We move on.
Right, like 10 little Indians.
Right. Well, what happens is when you do that, first, you set yourself up for a battle because it's really easy to keep score. Well, you won that one, and then you won the next one. No, I have to win this one.
That's
right?
Mm-hmm.
But even more importantly, if you go issue by issue, you have lost the capacity to create value in the interaction. And what do I mean by that? Well, let's say we have multiple issues in the negotiation. I don't care about that. Not all the issues are equally important. Some are more important. Some are less important. If I go issue by issue, even on issues that aren't very important to me, I'm going to really fight about. But if we can package those issues, then I'm going to be much more willing to give on the issues that aren't important to me in order to get on the ones that are, so I can yoke these issues together and in doing so make the pie larger. And at the end of the day, it's a lot easier to take a bigger slice of a bigger pie.
Right. Okay, so kind of what I'm hearing is instead of the art of the deal, it's the art of the concession. Or what's the relation between the word concession in the context of negotiation?
Well, concessions are critical. But what I need to be is mindful of the kind of concessions I'm making.
Right.
So, for example, I need to understand what is more or less important to me. Right? That's part of my planning and preparation. In addition, I need to actually begin to understand in my planning and preparation and verify in my actual negotiation with you what's more or less important to you. And then I'm going to try to craft a solution where I'm going to try to give you things that you care a lot about that I don't care so much about and get things at the same time. We're going to make that trade, that concession. I'm going to concede on that, and I'm going to encourage you to concede on ones that are important to me that are less important to you.
Okay.
And that's how you create value. But one of the things that I think is so critical to understand is when you have a package, that's a lot easier to do. If you go issue by issue, in fact, we even have a strategy people use called solve the easy issues first.
Okay.
Okay. It seems reasonable. That seems like a reasonable strategy because we solve a few easy issues, we get some commitment, it's harder to walk away, we're more likely to get a deal, all those things happen. But there are two huge downsides and why I encourage people not to use that strategy. The first one is, pretty simply, if you solve all the easy issues, what's left? The really ugly, big issue. And now you have nothing to trade. All you can do is fight.
Mm-hmm.
And you end in a battle, right? And the battle is not going to be pleasant.
No.
Number two, and probably more importantly, solve the easy issues first assumes that your easy issues are my easy issues. What if they're not? What if we solve an easy issue for me, but it turns out to be really important for you? Then I've lost a lever in my negotiation because I could have used that concession to get something that would be good for me.
I see. That's interesting. We're speaking with Dr. Margaret Neal. She's the author of Getting More of What You Want. She's also a professor of negotiation and other things at Stanford University. We've been talking a lot about jobs and job negotiations because I think a lot of people have stress around that. What's an example of an emotional negotiation that we might have to go through? And you can refer to your TEDx talks if you like, because that was a really good example. It kept me riveted for 14 minutes and 54 seconds.
Well, thank you. So I did a TEDx talk on a negotiation that has been a challenge for me for years. And that was a negotiation with my 15-year-old quarter horse mare. So you may have thought I was going with my 15-year-old child, but no, it's my horse. And what I talk about there is that while I teach negotiation and do research in negotiation and write books in negotiation, that sometimes it's hard even for me to remember what I need to do in situations that sometimes you don't even conceptualize as a negotiation, because after all, my horse does not speak words,
right?
But she does have a language. The language of horses is the language of touch and feel, of pressure and release. And so what happened was is that I had a goal in mind for us, and being the human, you know, I'm the one who sets the goal and she's the horse, so she comes along. But she was not a willing partner, and she was telling me the whole time how this was not good for her, and I didn't pay attention. Up until a point where she finally started rearing on me. And rearing, for those of you who are not sort of immersed in the horse world, is not the exciting thing that you see with Roy Rogers or the Lone Ranger.
Right.
It's a scary thing, and it's a very dangerous thing both for horse and rider. I could be crushed or killed if she falls over backwards, and if she fell over backwards, she could easily hit her head and create such a concussion that it would kill her immediately.
Right.
So it's a dangerous thing. But she was rearing, and I couldn't keep her with all 4 feet on the ground. And so that was the time. This is the equivalent of a huge impasse. We were at an impasse. We were nowhere near an agreement. Our interests were not aligned. And so what I had to do was go back and begin again to try to understand what I had failed. And what I'd failed to do was realize, and this is true in negotiation. You see, the notion of I can just force you into a deal is wrong, because you can always walk away from a negotiation. Mm-hmm. Now, Sal, my horse, couldn't walk away, but she could resist. And so what happened was is that I forgot that I needed her willing agreement to engage in these series of activities that we were trying to do. And so I had to go back, because you see, what her concern was, and I may be anthropomorphizing a bit here, but her concern was is that when she didn't have her other horse buddies around and I was asking her to do stuff away from them, that she felt at risk, because she's a prey animal and her safety is in the herd. And so when I pulled her away from the herd and had her do stuff and the herd was going and doing something else, she really wanted to be with them, not with me, because she didn't see me as a leader. She didn't see me as someone who could support her, who could protect her.
And you weren't seeing how she was valuing that at the time.
Yes, I wasn't. Okay. And then I discovered that that was really something I needed to pay attention to. My teachers, I went back to them and said, help me. And they said, look, you forgot. It's not a dictatorship. It's a partnership. You need to go back and recreate the partnership where she sees you as a source of comfort, where she looks to you for leadership. And when things are a little dicey, she trusts that you will keep her safe.
I see. That's the value of, yeah, the value of valuing in a lot of ways, too. I always like to ask towards the end if I've skipped anything by accident, something that you wanted to really talk about. And it's okay if there's a no to that.
No, there's actually lots of stuff I'd like to talk about. But let me just give you one thing that I want to highlight. And it kind of reflects back to the first question, which is, where do I get the bravery to ask? Mm-hmm. And part of the challenge here is that negotiation is actually a very different experience for men than for women. And let's talk a little bit about how it's different for women. And it turns out that for women, the playing field is not level. Women get punished for negotiating in ways that men do not, especially if the person with whom they're negotiating is a male superior. Uh-huh. I guess the sort of tongue-in-cheek good news is if the superior that you as a male and I as a female am negotiating with is female, we both get punished. So, you know, there's
wow.
That. But because we're perceived as being greedy or demanding, right? So how do we do that? How do we negotiate without being perceived as greedy or demanding?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's critical for women, but it's also important for men. So I'm not saying this is only for women, this is for everybody, is that problem-solving orientation. To basically couple your ask with a solution to your counterpart's problems. How can you doing what I'm asking you to do make you better off?
Mm-hmm.
How can I solve a problem for you, for your team, for your organization? And that is so critical to help women and men be more effective in negotiation. So we need to understand that if we're just going to come in and ask for a raise, there's likely to be a bigger backlash for using exactly the same words if I'm female than if I were male, right? So how do we basically mitigate that difference? And it's that problem-solving orientation, focusing on the package, right? And for women, what gets us to the negotiation is to raise our expectations about what we could be, what we could achieve.
Right on. Well, I'm glad you extrapolated on that, because this is a problem that dogs the bro-economy, as we call it here in Silicon Valley, the gender inequality that the Valley's trying, I hope, to assert. Dr. Margaret Neal and her book is Getting More of What You Want. Thank you so much for your time and your expertise.
You're certainly welcome.
That was Dr. Margaret Neal, a Stanford professor and author of Getting More of What You Want, How the Secrets of Economics and Psychology Can Help You Negotiate Anything in Business and in Life. There's a link on our Facebook page, facebook.com/techonomics. Now, sticking with the women leaders theme, there was a headline we wanted to pull out around income and gender equality. In what can only be considered a groundbreaking effort to close the wage gap between men and women, Massachusetts has become the first state to bar employers from asking about applicants' salaries before offering them a job. The new law requires hiring managers to state a compensation figure up front based on what an applicant's worth is to the company rather on what that person made in a previous position. Now, it's not a mandatory wage equality solution, but it does put another crack in the ceiling. Coming up after this short break, we have This Week in Elon Musk, as well as a new technology that helps dogs take selfies on their own and then text them to you. I'm Jason Middleton, and this is Techonomics.